Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Pamela Nance. Before I bring her on, I need to remind you, you can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Definitely check us out on Rockfin. That's where you get all our premium content, regular shows, and all the premium content from all of the awesome creators on Rockfin. We have our merch store up. Get you some t-shirts, some stickers, bags, all kinds of cool stuff. That link is in the description. And finally, check out the great products at Ascent Nutrition. They're an amazing all-natural health and nutrition company. And not only do they have supplement categories on their website, like vitality and energy and healthy metabolism, you're going to see brain focus, intuition, and consciousness. If you are ready to optimize your meat suit, feel better right now, check out Ascent Nutrition. That link is in the description. Tonight, I want to welcome to the show Pamela Nance. She has a master's degree in anthropology and archaeology with minor degrees in religion and sociology. She recently retired from one of the top 25 medical universities in the United States following a 30-year career in biostatistical and sociological research. For nearly 40 years, she has been an active investigator in the survival of consciousness after death, and as a result, became a trained healing touch practitioner, past life regressionist, and hypnotherapist, trained shaman, and dowser. She has a movie and podcast in post-production exploring consciousness and interdimensional communication. A film project documenting what is potentially one of the most fascinating and prolonged alien contact cases on record. Pamela, welcome back. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thank you so much for having me back on your show. I really appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Of course. Yeah. Last time we kind of just barely scratched the surface of a little bit of your history and the story. Tonight, we're going to be discussing more about that case, which involved missing time. And it occurred in June of 2015, where you, Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin brought a research team to investigate a location that supposedly experienced frequent UFO activity. We're going to talk about that, as well as I want to get your insights into different aspects of this phenomenon and what's going on now with disclosure. Before we discuss this, though, it's been a while since you've been on. Could you remind the audience what really got you involved with working with paranormal, metaphysics, and ufology in general?
Well, it pretty much started from a lifetime of experiencing just high strangeness that began when I was a small child around the age of five. I grew up in a rural area of Western North Carolina, raised in the Southern Baptist Church. My mother, however, was Native American and Spanish Basque. And so she had some influence coming in from that line of heritage that opened her up to other possibilities rather than just strictly religious dogma. She was open to interpreting dreams, intuition. Her great-grandmother was full-blooded Cherokee. And so as a result, my great grandmother and two great aunts were midwives, root doctors, healers, and that just kind of came down through the maternal line within my family. And so as a very small child, I can recall her telling stories about, you know, my ancestors and telling ghost stories. And so it wasn't unusual for me to have that type of exposure. But beginning around the age of five, I found that I could bilocate out of my body. And just to give you a little bit of setting for the place where I grew up, it's an 1850s log cabin that was built in the early settlement period of that part of North Carolina, primarily Moravians from Europe. But the property itself sits in a strategic area as far as two ley lines that intersect about 20 miles to the west. at a mountain called Pilot Mountain. And the ley lines are the serpent ley that runs from south of Mount Denali and north of Mount Shasta across Serpent Mound in Ohio, down across Pilot Mountain, down through the Cape Fear River Valley of North Carolina, and out to the Bermuda Triangle. The Acadian ley runs from Mexico City up into North America across Pilot Mountain, intersecting with Serpent Ley, out to the north and over to Stonehenge. So the Pilot Mountain is sacred in many aspects, not only because of this intersection of these two powerful ley lines within sacred geometry, but also to the native Sora American Indians who held it as a very sacred spiritual place for their tribe. My home where I grew up is about, as I said, 20 miles away from that mountain. So as a child, I could sit in the backyard and the best way I can describe it, I could pop out of my body and almost fly like a bird across the terrain of the land to that mountain and then back home again. And I shared that information with my mom and a couple of my siblings, but was told, you know, that's fine, you know, if this is happening to you, but you don't want to talk about it outside the home. So I pretty much just kept it to myself, and I was able to do that from about the ages of 5 until 9. And I don't know if I just outgrew it or became interested, you know, in other things. But the next event that happened to me, I was 10 years old in my room one night in bed. And I had two beings appear beside my bed. They were human looking people, male and a female, very attractive, standing over me, dressed in black. They both had black turtlenecks on, black tight-fitting pants. The man had hair a little below the turtleneck, light brown. The woman had light brown hair, shoulder length with bangs. And the man was holding a huge timepiece. And he said, as it counted down from 12 to 12, basically at 60 seconds, that they were going to take me. And this was because I was being taken to balance my karma for the beheading of a sacred white elephant in a past life. So I can tell you, as a 10-year-old Southern Baptist child, I knew nothing about the Hindu religion, but they were imparting this information to me. And of course, you know, this was very strange and frightening. And the next thing I recall was like being, I guess, on board a craft. I was lying on a metal table, and these two beings, I could see that they were working above my head. And that's pretty much I remember until I woke, or I came to in my room, and I thought I'd been beheaded. That was what, in my 10-year-old mind, I had thought it happened to me, and I was hysterical, you know, crying. My parents could not convince me that I had, you know, I still had my head, but I know this sounds kind of bizarre, but that's how I interpreted the situation, that my head had been decapitated. They finally settled me down after several hours, but I really experienced PTSD from that, event for at least 15 years. Anytime the same lighting was recreated, I would go right back to that event. The interesting thing, and I only connected these two events as an adult, just a couple of days later, I woke and I had a very severe rash, just bright red, very fine from the neck up, covering my entire head. My parents took me to the doctor. He questioned my mom about, you know, something maybe I'd been exposed to, new detergent, something like that. They really couldn't come up with anything. But I was out of school for a couple of weeks before, you know, the rash subsided. But as an adult, and, you know, these events kept occurring, you know, I'm kind of connected the two, that perhaps I'd been exposed to something on board the craft as these beings were working, you know, to balance my karma. But at any rate, that was a major event as a 10-year-old. Then right before the summer before my 11th birthday, this would have been 1967. It was a summer evening. My entire family, my parents and three siblings, we were out on the front porch after dinner, just enjoying the night air. It was not quite dark yet. And my little 5-year-old brother exclaimed, "Look," and across the road above this stand of southern pines set a silver disc, not that high above the trees. My entire family saw it. We jumped up. We were, you know, pretty excited, pointing, you know, talking about the UFO across the road. And as in the blink of an eye, it was gone. It shot from east to west and was out of there. Well, due west would have been a straight shot to Pilot Mountain. And, you know, in retrospect and after doing research and the study of electromagnetic energy and the grids around the Earth, you know, I can't help but think that was not coincidental that it went in the direction of that mountain. Then as a 16-year-old, I had an out-of-body experience during a tonsillectomy. I didn't leave the room. I was in the recovery room, but I did sit up and step out of my body and walk around the table. And I saw myself lying on the gurney and realized, you know, I needed to get back into my body. I just remember thinking, oh, crap, you know, I'm out of my body. I need to get back in my body. When I woke in my room, my family was standing over me. The doctor was there. The nurse was there. And they looked very concerned. And my sister started crying. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. But evidently, they'd had a really difficult time waking me up from the surgery. And I managed to ask the nurse, you know, the only thing I could think about was seeing myself in the recovery room. So I asked her, you know, are there mirrors in the recovery room? And of course, she said, no, there aren't any mirrors there. And they asked, why did I ask? And I was just like, you know, no reason. I thought, I'm not even going to go into this. But so that was a pretty, you know, major event that happened to me. And in 1989, I was living in the home I'm in now. Out front is a 300-year-old oak tree. And so I went out one evening to get the mail. It was not quite dark. And I sensed just something over me and looked up, and there was one of those gigantic black triangular craft that you hear about. And there was quite a rash of those sightings during the late 80s, early 90s. And it was that typical silent, gigantic black triangular craft. I don't recall seeing any lights, but it wasn't dark. It was about dusk. But it was sitting just the oak tree's probably 500 feet tall. It's gigantic. The craft was not that far above the oak tree, just sitting there, making no sound, not moving. My husband was inside the house. I'm screaming for him. Of course, he couldn't hear me. It felt like this went on forever, but it was probably only a couple of minutes. And the craft just shot out of sight. It went due south. So, of course, I tuned into the local news that night. And there was reported sightings of a craft being seen south of here in a little town called Salisbury. So that is the direction the craft flew in. But there was nothing on the local news. And, you know, I thought how odd. This thing was gigantic. I live just right off of a fairly busy road. How could people not have seen this huge craft sitting there? It just didn't make any sense. So the next evening I went out and was hoping maybe to see it again. And there were two little boys walking up my circle and they were looking upward. And so I walked out to the street and, you know, just to ask, what are you looking at? And they were probably about 11 or 12. And they said, we were hoping we saw the UFO we saw last night. So I had corroboration, but from, you know, two little boys. But what's really interesting about the story is a year later, I started graduate school. And so I was meeting with the head of the anthropology department. And he saw where I lived, my address. And he said, well, I lived on your circle. I just moved away within the last year. He said, you know, my little boy saw a UFO on that circle. And I had corroboration from the head of the anthropology department. And we discussed it a little bit. I told him that I'd also seen it. And he believed me. He believed his son. So I felt really good about at least having some corroboration of what I had seen. And so throughout all of those experiences, I also had paranormal things happening to me as a child. And in this home where I've lived for 41 years, some of the first activity I experienced here was of the paranormal, disembodied voices, apparitions, sometimes full body, sometimes just shadow figures. Not only myself, but my husband has seen these things, my stepdaughter, even my cats. You know, I see my cats looking at things that we don't see. We always laugh and say, oh, they see dead people. And we've had, you know, visitors here that have seen or heard things that, you know, kind of freak them out. So just, you know, a lifetime of high strangeness.
You know, it's very, very interesting that you have experienced a lifetime of high strangeness, paranormal, mixed with extraterrestrial, seemingly, or UFOs. And the guest that I just had on earlier today and I were talking about the profound connections between ufology and the paranormal and people's experiences. Many people who have contact experiences or have seen multiple UFOs or been even taken on a craft have also experienced a lot of paranormal activity. So it seems to go hand in hand, and it seems to be incredibly connected in some way. Is this something you've also found with other people that you've worked with as well?
Absolutely. And I think it's just a matter of consciousness. It's all about consciousness coming through into, you know, the Earth's astral plane. You know, if you think about the universe and the connectivity that we have at a, you know, an electron level, you know, at a cellular level, we're energy beings that vibrate. And even scientists are now referring to electronic or electron energy as vibrational energy. You know, quantum entanglement, if you get into quantum theory, there are a lot of answers there about the means and the mechanism for consciousness. And so many scientists are really starting to look at that. So, you know, my belief system is that, okay, I believe in reincarnation, that, you know, we cycle through many, many lives, that we can't possibly learn all that we need to in just one short lifetime. And I think here on the planet Earth, we're at the low end of the totem pole universally. So we've got a lot to learn. And if we believe that we all come and cycle through at various stages, we can't all come in with the same level of consciousness. If some of us have lived 10,000 lifetimes and others only a few hundred, we're going to be on different levels of consciousness. So I think people who experience this overlap of activity, paranormal, ufology, metaphysical, you know, the whole gamut, it's because possibly we've existed over many, many lifetimes. And each time we retain some of that knowledge as we come back through, even though we don't remember it, you know, we supposedly are born with amnesia, but things do come through, whether it's through intuition or just a knowing. So I think that begins to change you at a vibrational level, at an electron level, you know, at a cellular level. And if we're vibrating at different frequencies, some more than other, then we're going to draw those things to us.
Yeah, I think you're right, because when it comes to contact and paranormal phenomenon, I was kind of chasing for that. I was, you know, asking for it, wanting it to happen, because I just wanted proof for so long. And, you know, it happened. And the more that I kind of asked for it and accepted the phenomenon, became comfortable with it, the more it occurred. It's like the more you interact with it, the you know, the stronger the connection you have to it, right? I guess, you know. Now, I do want to get to the incident in 2015 with Missing Time. Could you tell the audience how you got involved with this case, and what was this all about?
Sure. So after experiencing everything that I described, and my stepdaughter having many of those same experiences herself, in the about 2008, we formed a paranormal team. It's when the popularity and the paranormal shows had increased, and equipment was readily available. So we purchased, you know, a spirit box, the device that sweeps FM frequencies at a millisecond rate. And the theory is it provides white noise, an energy platform for communication to come through in the form of electronic voice phenomena. And EVP has a long history going all the way back to Edison and Tesla and a lot of the, you know, spiritualists in the 30s. But so our primary focus was communication. We decided we really didn't want to go to sites for haunting phenomena. We weren't that interested in being scared. We were more interested in, what's happening here? How are these beings communicating? How are they coming through? How are they materializing? So we chose historic sites just because the South, you know, has abundant sites, and we knew there was a lot of history there. And as an archaeologist and anthropologist, I'm very interested in our past. And so, so was Ashley. So we approached it sort of as an archaeological dig, going to each site, going in, digging down through the layers prior to the investigation, and developing a timeline of occupancy, sometimes taking sites back to the 1600s. And that really seemed to resonate. We got great historic EVP coming through. We solved a lot of mysteries for management at some of these historic plantations. They had questions about different, you know, buildings and footprints on the property, and we were able to obtain information and then research and validate it on the back end. But it seemed like after a couple of years, as we got into that methodology and we asked, you know, where are you? How are you coming through? We began to receive not the historic timeline any longer, but what seemed to be off-planet or interdimensional communication. They would tell us they were coming through portals or wormholes. They, you know, would give us the name of their planet and their dimension. So that kind of put us on a path of studying quantum physics. You know, what are we encountering here? We've now past the historic realm, and we seem to be into the interdimensional communication. So we gained some popularity amongst investigators, and we were invited to present at Dragon Con in Atlanta in 2013.
Now, I just have to ask, did you do anything different to the equipment that changed anything?
Nothing.
Okay.
We were still using the Spirit Box 7, digital recorders, video cameras, 35 millimeter cameras. We just ask, I guess, the right questions, or possibly, you know, we have raised our vibrations even more at that point to communicate,
right,
you know, beyond the historic timeline. So we decided to combine the historic with quantum theory. And so we did sort of a quantum paranormal presentation for Dragon Con. And we were lucky that year that Stanton Friedman was also there. He had been invited to present about Roswell. And we met him prior to our presentation and invited him to come, you know, join us. And he really liked our approach, our scientific methodology, and was quite blown away by some of the audio that we had captured. So afterwards, we had, you know, several nice discussions with him, and he introduced me to Kathleen Martin. Kathleen is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, a longtime friend of Stanton's, and also the director of the MUFON Experiencer research team. But Kathleen had paranormal events throughout her lifetime, not just the ET events, but also paranormal. So he thought, you know, we could really benefit in meeting Kathleen, sharing our information with her. And so we made that connection and stayed in communication with her from, I would say we were able to connect in early 2014. And by 2015, we actually met her in person with Denise Stoner. And we met at Denise's home. And Denise is also a member of MUFON and has experienced a lot of ET contact since she was about 2 years old, but also paranormal. And she had some paranormal activity going on in her home. So we visited her, conducted an investigation. And at that point, we decided, hey, it would be great to actually go to a site where we could apply our paranormal methodology, but at a site where a known ET abduction had occurred. And Kathleen had been introduced to Chris Bledsoe, who had his own experience with abduction in 2007. And so she had been introduced to him through MUFON. And since Chris is also in North Carolina, she thought, well, this would be a really good fit for us, and made the introduction to Chris. And so just within a matter of really just a few days, we had set up the date to visit Chris's property in the eastern part of North Carolina. And that's in the Cape Fear River Valley area.
Now, I've heard Chris Bledsoe's story and everything that's happened surrounding his house. And it's, again, another event with a gamut of phenomenon from, you know, paranormal to UFOs. What were some of the things that you were told were, you know, occurring there that kind of were intriguing to you?
Well, his actual abduction with his son occurred down by the Cape Fear River in 2007. But after that event, he had numerous events occur at his home. One in particular was this tree that would spontaneously erupt into flame. It's a catalpa tree, and the catalpa is a very old native tree to North Carolina. But this tree was situated in the backyard of behind his home, and I'd say it's about probably 40 feet tall. And just one day it burst into flames. And he tried time and time again for several days to put the fire out. And he has videos of he and his son spraying the tree. And you can see it spontaneously re-erupt into flame. So that was one significant event that we had heard about. In addition, he had lots of orb activity. And I'm not talking about just these translucent, you know, dust orbs. These are vibrant, energetic orbs that seem to be emitting energy from within themselves. And they're multicolored, not just your bright white orbs, but orange and green and various colors. So lots of orb activity taking place on his property. He had his dog had like some type of bleed out event right in front of his eyes. Started bleeding from his throat and then just spontaneously stopped bleeding. And I think Grant Cameron actually witnessed that. So that was, you know, kind of strange. Chris also has had multiple experiences of seeing the vision of the Shining Lady on his property, which is like an angelic type being. So, you know, we had heard those stories and we were very intrigued to go there to see what type of evidence we could capture.
Now, once you're there, talk about some of the events that happened, including the missing time.
So the property is about 3.5 hours from where I live. And we arrived there, I would say, about 1 o'clock that afternoon in June of 2015. We met the family, very nice, close-knit family. His mom lives next door. I think they have like 4 children. We met all of the children and the wife, and just a very loving, nice, intelligent family. We heard a lot about what the kids were involved in. And then we heard, you know, some of the stories about the events that had occurred there on the property. We did a short EVP session in the house and had some pretty good, you know, EVP come through, indicating that there was a portal within the home. And so that, you know, really kind of got us psyched for the evening. We went out, we walked the property for quite some time, and Chris showed us the tree and showed us some areas of the yard where strange activity had occurred. And so the plan was that evening to, just focus or set up ourselves under the tree, since the tree seemed to be sort of the point of a lot of the events. We had planned to go out around 7 that evening, but a huge thunderstorm pushed through, and that delayed us going out until about 10 o'clock. But it did clear the night air. It ended up being a beautiful starlit night with about a 78% full moon. So we got out there about 10. We set up the video camera with night vision about 15 feet behind the catalpa tree. We wanted to make sure that we had a nice panoramic view of that tree, since that seemed to be a big area of focus. And I would say we stood by the camera for about 9 minutes and just chatted with Chris and his wife. Some of the other family members were walking around in the yard, and Ashley and I and Chris and his wife stood and talked for about 9 minutes. At some point in those 9 minutes, Ashley saw that the battery and the video camera was going low. And that was strange because it had been fully charged when we went out, but we found that that often occurred, you know, on these investigations, our equipment would drain. So she returned to the house, grabbed a fresh battery, but she didn't need to replace it right away because the camera was still running. So we approached, left the video camera and approached the tree and began the investigation. So at that point, it was only a few minutes, you know, probably 10, 15. Although I'd had my spirit box and digital recorder running since about 10 o'clock. So we walk away from the tree. We set ourselves up under the tree and began asking questions. And we asked sort of the typical questions about, you know, who's here? What do you have to say? Who's coming through? And started noticing that we were had gone beyond any type of paranormal communication as far as any historic timeline, that it seemed to be more of off-planet type communication, that they were directing us to look at the moon. And at this point, the family had returned to the house, and it was just Chris, Ashley, and I doing the investigation. So we hear, you know, we're at the moon, we're circling, we're behind the moon. And Chris had noticed pretty much right off the bat that there was appeared to be a really bright star to the left of the moon. Well, when we heard these EVPs coming through, we started really looking closely at that bright light and wondering, is that really a star? And we determined it was not a star, that it was just much too bright. The other stars, you know, were further out, and this was just directly to the left of the moon. And then coupled with these EVPs that were coming through, we asked additional questions, you know, who are you? Where are you from? And started receiving responses that they were coming through from Adela. Well, Adela was a communication that Ashley and I had started getting probably around 2011, 2012, when we would ask, where are you from? Adela, that was the name of their planet. So again, that night, they're telling us Adela, we're coming through from Adela. So, you know, we ask our, you know, all of these questions, trying to get as much information as we could. And we are standing there, you know, looking at this bright light. And then the next thing the three of us recall, we're still standing there, but none of our equipment is in our hands. It's no longer in our hands. It's not anywhere around us. And I feel really sick and dizzy, nauseous. And I mentioned that to Ashley and Chris, and they said they didn't feel well either. And we were all standing kind of shoulder to shoulder, just sort of swaying, and we're still looking at the moon, but the bright light is gone. And we don't feel well. Well, at that point, I turned around and all of our equipment was on the ground behind us, turned off. And that's counterintuitive to the whole point in being there. Our equipment, that is our primary tool for investigating. And we didn't remember turning the equipment off. We've never done that before. Why would we do that? But we felt really dazed and kind of confused. And we just sort of shrugged it off as being, you know, we'd had this long day, this long drive, all this interaction. I remember just kind of picking the equipment up, feeling just kind of out of it. And Ashley and Chris and I, we walked towards the video camera, and it had continued to run. she had gone back right before we really got into looking at the bright light, because she looked back and the red light on the camera had gone off. So she had replaced the battery, the one that had been running low in those first 9 minutes. But at that point, the camera had continued to run. And so she shut it off, gathered it up, and we returned to the house. So as we entered the back door, Chris's wife came running frantically out of the bedroom, asking, where have we been? And we were like, we've been in the backyard. And she said, no, I've been looking for you. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And so we were really quite surprised by that it was 1 o'clock. It was just 10 o'clock. And we felt like we had only been out there for a short period of time, but she's telling us it's 1 o'clock in the morning. So again, we were just like, we didn't know what to say. You know, we were in the backyard. But our, you know, I had to drive home 3.5 hours. So I just wanted some coffee. I wanted to try to wake up. And so, you know, we gathered ourselves together, got our equipment, packed up the car, and drove away from Chris's house. We probably went like a huge city block back around to this 4-lane highway that would take us back into the interstate area where we needed to get back home. But as we turned onto this smaller 4-lane highway, we noticed at above this little shopping center, a huge bright shooting light that was just barely above the treetops. And it shot from left to right at a really high speed, just bright as day. And all I could think to say was, oh, look, a shooting star. And Ashley thought the same thing. And, you know, we just continued on, but we were really just sort of out of it. Usually after an investigation, we're very animated, talkative, but we were very quiet on the ride home. Got back here probably about 5 in the morning, slept a few hours. She got back on the road to Georgia and I began reviewing the evidence. So I'm listening to my audio. I downloaded it, and I had only 1 hour and 15 minutes of recorded audio. Well, if we went out at 10, that would take us to 11:15, but we didn't go inside until 1 in the morning. So we had 1 hour and 45 minutes of missing audio. So I called Ashley, and she was still en route to Georgia. I said, look, as soon as you get home, review your video, because something strange happened. I'm missing 1 hour and 45 minutes of audio. You know, all I've got's 1 hour and 15 minutes. But at the end of that 1 hour and 15 minutes, something really strange happened. You can hear Ashley say, as though she's being instructed by someone, she says, so you want us to turn off all of our equipment? And I say, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah, let's turn off all of our equipment. And I tell her that. I said, for some reason, we're talking about turning off all of our equipment, but neither of us had any conscious recall of doing that or saying that. So she got home, immediately reviewed the video, and she said, yeah, something strange happened. In that first 9 minutes of video, she noticed in the last, I'd say, not even a full minute, the last 45 seconds, there's like this little, barely seen sort of these little legs coming up from about 5 o'clock at the bottom of the frame, sort of coming up into the the video. And then there's a flash, this sort of bluish light flashes, and you can see this large being sitting up in that catalpa tree. And he's dressed in a black bodysuit. His skin is creamy colored. And he appears to have like some type of almost night vision or something on the side of his head. She said, there's like this weird creature in the tree. And that's the direction her video camera was pointing. It was the backside of that catalpa tree. So if that happened in the first, you know, in those first 9 minutes, and really in those last 45 seconds, that being was up in the tree as we were standing around on the other side, noticing that bright light to the left of the moon. So that was kind of, you know, a little earth-shattering for us to see that guy sitting there.
Yeah, I can imagine. And we actually have some photos and the audio of the EVP that kind of picked up these entities telling you, you know, what they're doing. And we actually get to take a little closer look at that. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to share my screen so we can first listen to that audio, and then we'll take a look at some of the pictures.
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it.
Yep.
Good. Yeah,
can you see us? Can you see us? Tell us about Adela. Where is Adela? Tell us about Adela. Where is Adela?
All right, that was cool. You can actually hear pretty clearly some of the words that they're saying there.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm going to go to some of the images. You see my folder here. Which one should I pull up?
So the at the bottom, the video still shot of the okay. large entity.
Let me pull that up here. Can you see that on my screen?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what we saw initially in viewing the video. So you can see this guy. He's sitting up in that catalpa tree. And it appears, you know, he's got this black bodysuit on. You can see the his arms are almost kind of tucked behind him. And his knees appear to be bent. And there's, you know, his head is brightly lit. You almost see like a slit for a mouth. And then looking at the screen, it would be on our left, but his right, it's sort of lit up almost like he's got some kind of headgear on. So that's what we saw initially at the end of that 9 minute video.
Let's see. And you have another one of that one. Large.
Yeah. So I think there are about five. You can just pick on it. Pick any of those that you want to.
I pull up the enhanced color enhanced one. All right.
Yeah. So,
yeah, you can see how brightness that whatever it is he's got on his head.
Yeah, there seems to be like a little round light there on the.
You can definitely see the arms made out here.
Yeah.
That's really cool. All right, let me pull up the other one. There's another color enhanced one. Yeah. Okay, now we can go to the smaller entity.
Right. So he first starts out just like he's materializing.
It is.
Yeah. So this is what we saw coming up from about 5 o'clock at the bottom of the frame before the larger entity flashed into view. So this little guy is like sort of running up.
Right.
That was the first image that we captured.
Let's see if we can go to this.
And then, yeah. So this small, well, that's when he actually leaves the frame at the end. The next one would be the small entity materializing.
Yeah, gotcha.
So there he is. He's materialized, and he appears to like have some type of blue energy source, you know, in front of him, and it almost looks like his knees are bent as he's moving upward.
Yeah, that looks strange. See, I'll pull up an enhanced version of that. You can make it out a little better. Yeah.
Yeah. He also appears to maybe have something on like the top of his head. I don't know. I just get like this feel, this sort of Egyptian look from him for some reason.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Were you? Yeah. That's a good one.
We have this other enhanced one. Yeah, I wish we could, let me see if I can get in larger on that. There we go. That's really cool. You can definitely make out the head, and looks like he's got even some kind of robe or something maybe on.
Yeah, and like that blue light is very significant to the entire experience. He first morphs into an orb.
Oh, let's see. I think you have that one.
Yeah.
To an orb. There we go.
That one. Yeah.
Wow.
And then he shoots off in that one you just showed and leaves the frame. But in watching the video, when he materializes and comes up through the each frame, he ends up behind the larger guy and then turns into the orb and shoots back down. So Kathleen Martin and a retired military intelligence officer painstakingly went through the video frame by frame, and they pulled these images out for us. And the retired military intelligence person said that it appears that when this little guy leaves, that he exits through what looks like a portal of blue light. So he's working a little further into that, trying to, you know, enhance those pieces frame by frame. But it was just a really bizarre night, because we focused, you know, on this investigation, hoping to have communication. And as it turns out, we not only had communication, but we experienced an abduction. And the reason I say that, during the missing time, the hour and 45 minutes, as the video camera continued to run, we have tons of audio. You don't hear myself, Ashley, or Chris, but you hear voices indicating that we're being abducted. And I think I sent you that transcript. But if you want, I could read those to the audience.
Sure,
I don't
know. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, this is what came through the EVP, right?
Right. So this came off of the video camera's audio.
Right.
And it was during that hour and 45 minutes when we were not there. So they're saying, "We're here, picking up. They're out. They're out back. They are looking up now. They can see us. They've seen us. Call them while they're looking. Don't change positions. We'll get them. Get upwind. Do we want to take them? They're breathers, people. We take them. Okay, then. Go. Get them. Together. Get them up to the craft. Let them come up first. We have got them. We took them. Good. We need them. We're boarding. Take over. Move them. I move them. Okay. Buckle up. Moving off. Hold tight. Turn us. Ping them. Jump ahead. Back up. That better. Set course. All forward. Go. Thrust. We did it.
Very interesting. this type of phenomenon that has everything from strange paranormal events to aliens and UFOs, when you look at it, it's so hard to break down, especially if you're a hardcore scientific researcher and you look at some of the high strangeness that occurs, some of the events. It's like, you know, what can you say to piece some of these things together? I think we need more people from all of these fields, like from paranormal fields, quantum physics, ufology, to come together to better understand what's happening here, because it's such a wide range of high strangeness that we need more minds of different, different fields to come together and look at it. Maybe we might get a better picture of what's going on.
Right, yeah, a multidisciplinary team of physicists, neuroscientists.
It is kind of encouraging because I've seen more of that lately than I have before. You know, I just got back from the UFO mega conference last month, and there was a good integration of paranormal researchers, UFO researchers, and I met a couple of great paranormal researchers that are researching high strangeness areas like Skinwalker Ranch, the Uinta Basin, and a couple of undisclosed locations that maybe we'll find out the name of soon. But those are also very, very interesting how they have these high concentrated paranormal locations. But it's nice to see that they're getting together and kind of researching these areas and looking into these. And it's not just like our government doing this. It's independent research teams,
right.
Paranormal research teams, which makes me feel a little bit better about the whole thing. But speaking of our government, we've got so much talk about UFOs in the mainstream lately. I want to get your take on what's happening here. All of a sudden it's okay to talk about UFOs. This year we had our little released actually a few days ago from the Pentagon UAP report, which is kind of a letdown for me. Yeah. It was a big letdown actually, but you know, what do you expect? I didn't expect much, and I kept telling my audience not to expect much. So what do you think is happening with this? Do you think they're trying to just get ahead of something, or maybe want to roll out some new toys that they've had for a while, or something else? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I didn't get my hopes up for too much because we're talking about the federal government, you know, and they've been putting out misinformation for decades. You know, it started with Project Blue Book and
yes.
Has continued down through the decades. So I really didn't have my hopes up for much. And, you know, they released a 7-page report, and the actual full report was well over 80 pages, I think. So they gave us very little. And basically, you know, I'm disappointed with how they term it and like, you know, we need to find out what these things are because it's a threat. You know, they keep saying threat. And so why are they spinning it in that direction when clearly thousands of people have had contact? And, you know, we've had retired military personnel, government officials come forward, who are very credible, who have stories, who have evidence, who've had their own experiences, that are willing, you know, to cross the line and disclose. Yet, you know, the federal government wants to spin it as a threat. So is their agenda to militarize outer space? Is that what we're going to be hearing about? Some huge, you know, bill?
I'm sure that's one of them.
Yeah. You know, is that the game plan? I don't know. I just don't hold my breath for too much to come from those guys. I think it's going to come from the grassroots level and from people who are credible, that are willing, you know, to step forward. And we've seen that over the past couple of decades, you know, with retired military, retired CIA, you know, foreign intelligence that are willing to speak up. And now we're, you know, having scientists coming on board. You know, you look at folks like Michio Kaku, Stephen Greer. You know, these are well-educated individuals who have dedicated their lives to studying physics and quantum theory, and they're willing, you know, to step across that line and admit that, you know, this is not all there is. You know, there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, and it's kind of being painted as a threat by certain individuals, certain researchers, and somewhat by the government. And I was thinking, you know, if it's a threat, they could have destroyed us hundreds of times over.
Sure.
I'm thinking that our government is more of a threat than they are. But I'm also sure that there are ET races or species or whatever you want to call it that may not be fond of us and may be a threat. I don't know. I'm sure there's a mix of both good and bad out there. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, the majority of the stories I hear are very positive from other experiencers and researchers that, you know, overwhelmingly, I would say 75% of the reports are of a positive nature. But I do think, you know, just like here on planet Earth, that there are some bad guys out there that might not have our best intentions at heart. But, you know, I think for the most part, the people that I hear from who have had experiences, they become better citizens of the planet. You know, they're more ecologically minded. You know, they have a higher regard for animals and plant life and for each other. And so, you know, I think if we're drawing the attention from these interdimensional or interplanetary beings, I think it's because they don't want us to destroy ourselves, you know, and they've really started to make an appearance since the advent of nuclear weapons. You know, it's just escalated. And oftentimes you hear reports of them being around nuclear facilities or sightings at the time of the nuclear explosions and tests that were going on, because that type of energy reverberates out into the universe. It doesn't just impact our planet and our environment. It affects everything, and they don't want that fallout either. So, you know, I think they have to step in, and it's all part of raising this consciousness of us, you know, as a species here on this planet.
Yeah. Speaking of that, do you think that we are ready as a species, as human beings, to accept the fact that we're not the only ones here, that there is life out there? There always have been, and possibly they're even been walking among us this whole time. You think that we may be ready for that?
I think we're ready. I really do. You know, we need something more than just the doctrine, the religious doctrine, or the historic doctrine that we've been spoon-fed, you know, throughout our lives. if you research into our ancient past, and the timeline that we've been fed just doesn't make sense. And the history that we've been fed, it just doesn't add up. You know, if you start looking closely at the fossil record or at ancient sites, and there's so much more to the history of our planet than what we've been told. And I think people feel that at some, you know, unconscious level. And maybe that's part of the angst that's going on our planet right now amongst humans. You know, there's a feeling of unease, and I think it's because we don't know our true past. So why not, you know, why not? I think it could help us.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're definitely ready as a whole. I know that most of the people that I associate with in my life are ready for it. And I would hope that the rest of the human race is going to be catching up soon if they haven't already. But Pam, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was excellent. There's so much more stuff we could cover, so I'd love to have you back on in the future.
Sure.
Before you head out, let everyone know where they can find your work, if they want to get in touch with you, website, social media, all that good stuff.
Okay, I have a website, PamelaNance.com. There is a contact page, so if anyone would like to contact me that way, feel free to. I'm not involved in any social media right now. I kind of got out of that for a few years just because of the platforms and the way they were hitting. But, you know, I plan hopefully to get back involved in some of that, but the website would be, I guess, the best place. And I am in the process of drafting a book about the whole missing time event and all the high strangeness throughout my life. So that'll, you know, be coming hopefully within the next year. But I do have some of my paranormal evidence posted on the website and the missing time evidence. So that's a place that folks could go to.
And the website was?
PamelaNance.com.
PamelaNance.com. That simple.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Pamela, thank you so much for coming on again. Like I said, we'll have you back on in the future. There's so much more we could discuss.
It'd be my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Chris. Appreciate it.
Well, until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll see you again soon.